From my eyes I did not withhold what they sought. In what I held back from my heart, joys were not. My heart, it rejoiced in my work as in art. Though this was from all of my labor, my part. That was Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 10, in the Ward Green translation of 2020, our daily scripture or proverb for today, little children. And returning to the article, the Ark of Urartu, can you imagine a wooden ship as large as an acre in size? Chapter 1, paragraph 9. Why? The largest wooden ship built in modern times was the Wyoming, a schooner measuring 329.5 feet in length, 50 feet wide, 30.4 feet deep, and was launched December 15th, 1909, at the shipyard of Percy and Small, Bath, Maine, USA. She foundered in heavy seas in March of 1924, buckling with seams leaking and then sinking with the loss of all crew. Now, the fact remains that the Ark was bigger than the one that sank in 1924 and demonstrates a superior technology. Compare the dimensions there, if you would. You see that just about the exact same dimensions, except that the Ark was in cubits, which are more than 1.5 feet in the Egyptian cubit, whereas this schooner, the Wyoming, was about 300 feet and 50 feet and 30 feet, almost the same dimensions except in feet rather than in cubits. If one doubts that Noah's Ark is of superior technology to the Wyoming, one might do well to consider that the cargo capacity of the Ark is almost exactly 4 times the capacity of the Wyoming. Of course, if you consider a three-dimensional object, you have to take the difference in the dimensional size in one direction, such as, in this case, it looks like we could have 20.6 inches, right, divided by 12 inches, which is the difference between a cubit and a foot. And since the Wyoming was almost the same dimensions numerically, but in feet rather than cubits, this would be a ratio of 1.71. And that number, 1.72, let's say 1.717, actually, to be more precise, and then to the power of 3, because it's a three-dimensional object, to scale it up in 3 dimensions, by that factor, we would have an increase of 5 in volume. So the volume of, but of course, the length of the Wyoming was a little more than 300, so we'd have slightly less than 5 here. But that gives you a good idea that the Ark is at least 4 times larger in cargo capacity. But here I say almost exactly, because we know the capacity of the Wyoming. I suppose that's why I say almost exactly 4 times. We know enough to say this. But still, the Ark is enormous compared to the Wyoming, and they're both wooden boats. Keep that in mind. They're wooden boats, right? So they're very difficult. They're limited in terms of what they can do to resist all the stresses that come from the waves of the ocean, for example, or a big body of water like the deluge. When you look at this word hogging, and there are forces called hogging and sagging on ships, and one of the meanings of hogging here is to bend convex along its length because of the hull being supported in the middle and not at the ends. So you see, if the hull were supported in the middle, then the ends would be sagging, you know, but it's not called sagging. The sagging is the opposite. When the ends are supported and the middle sags, that's called sagging. But hogging is the opposite, where the middle is pushed up and then the ends tend to sink down. That can break a boat in half, except in the case of the Ark, it had a moon pool. And the moon pool, if we look back at the original picture at the beginning of the article, we see the moon pool is shown here as a central corridor in the Ark. And it has these transverse wall structures here at the back of this moon pool. And right at the back of the moon pool was where according to Mr. Windsor, the iron mounting points were for the anchors. Because if the anchors had been attached to the very rear of the vessel, it would have been impossible to steer the Ark. So it had to be somewhere in the middle. And in this case, the moon pool is this central corridor, which is open to the sea, so the sea can rise up and down in this moon pool, while the rest of the Ark is watertight. And this alleviates all of that hogging. And then, of course, because it has extra structure in the center, it also strengthens the center of the boat to resist the sagging stresses when the two ends of the boat are supported and not the middle. It makes sense to have such a thing as the moon pool. Now, the Ark, we jokingly say here, foundered, but in a mud flow. It didn't, and it was long after it landed, evidently, but it foundered in a mud flow, not in the water when it was being deployed. And it now lies at an elevation of about 6,300 feet. Yeah, it's still up in the mountain, showing that it was deployed during a time of very high seas when the deluge was very high upon the earth. Seriously, though, there's nothing worthy of speculation . Remember that there's an old saying about it: if ifs and ands were pots and pans, there'd be no trade for tinkers. In other words, if we had too many pots and pans, there wouldn't be a need for having a tinker to fix the pots and pans. And, you know, that wouldn't be good for the tinkers. But the ifs and ands are the things that probably should be worthy of minimizing. We should probably minimize the ifs and ands and stick to something more factual in general. The dimensions of the Ark of Noah from the Bible, that's from Genesis 6 and 15, where we noted those dimensions. 300, specifically the length, by 50, the width, by 30 cubits, the height of the Ark. And they're similar to the Wyoming, the schooner mentioned above, except that the Ark is bigger because cubits are more than feet, right? By the factor we just saw, about 1.7 something, a cubit is bigger than a foot in terms of the Egyptian cubit. The length of the Ark, as measured by David Fassold, was 6,180 inches. Yeah, this is something I'd sort of forgotten. That this is remarkable because that's the 618, right? The 1.618, which is the Phi number. And it actually comes out to 6,180. Remarkable. So it's a Phi number. That just doesn't happen, right, by accident. 6,180 divided by 12 would give us the number of feet. It's 515 feet, which is the measured length of the Ark relic on the mountain that is measured today and was measured by all of the scientists who studied it. And so that 6180 inches is not a coincidence, evidently, because it's a Phi number, 1.618. If we divide, as we saw before, we'll do it again, just to show, 1.618, or 1 divided by, I should say, 1 point divided by 1.618 is 0.618, right? So if we multiply it times 10,000, 6180, you see? So 6180, forget the decimal point, it's close enough. We have a Phi number in that 6180, which is really stunningly impressive. And the inch is a standard measure found in the Great Pyramid. So we have no reason to doubt that this 6180 inches was something deliberate, or that was based on the inch as known by Abraham even before the Great Pyramid, long before the Great Pyramid, centuries before when, or not Abraham, I should say, Noah. The inch, the evidence suggests here now, must have been known by Noah himself. Abraham was, of course, long after the Great Pyramid, or centuries after, but Noah was centuries before the Great Pyramid, if we date the Great Pyramid to about 2500 BC, but of course there are certainly debates about when the Great Pyramid was built. But the thing is, the inch, since it's in the Great Pyramid, it's not that unusual or far-fetched to believe that Noah knew about the inch also. So the 6180 inches, is it being a Phi number, it makes sense that that would be part of the design used by Noah, you know, because it has that characteristic of, you know, incorporating the Phi number right into it. It's so illuminating to see that. And the inch is a standard measure, or one of the standard measures used in the Great Pyramid, right? There are, of course, there's a need for dimensions that are, or units that are bigger than an inch. You know, it's typical that a structure as big as the Great Pyramid would use larger units also than just 1 inch, which is so small. But the inch was found to be a standard measure in some of these specific small structures that were found that demonstrated that, the size of the inch. The number 6180 becomes significant for the reason, as I just said, that it is a Phi number, Phi being the golden ratio. And also 1.618 and 2.618 are also Phi numbers. 2.618 is just 1.618 times itself, actually. We showed that before, right? The square root of 3 is something like 1.732. And 1.618 times itself is 2.618, which is sort of approaching 3. When the width of the arc given in the Bible is taken as a quotient of the beam, which is the maximum width, divided by 1.618, the maximum width of 138.88 feet is now calculated as follows. So, yeah, if we take the maximum width of the arc, which is measured as the beam at the widest point on the arc vessel we see today, divide it by 1.618, that maximum distance divided by 1.618, right, would give us, and we, you know, if we take that to equal the unit width, or the number of units, the number of cubits of width of the arc from the Bible, which was 50 cubits, average width, right? We can calculate in the other direction by multiplying the average width times that number Phi. We've shown this already. And we get 138.88 feet, right? When we convert from cubits to feet, as we did also here in this calculation. So, and all the definitions of the different numbers here are given, or the explanations given below here, as to what each number represents in that equation. So the maximum width can be calculated from the number of cubits given in the Bible for the width of the ark, 50. And we do arrive at 138, which is actually close to what was measured on the actual ark relic. It's really, really close, like really significantly close. The mistake a lot of people make is that they assume the ark is a box, but if the ark were a box, then the forces of the waves against it and so on would destroy it at sea, because no boat is a box, for that reason, that it needs to have a way of deflecting the waves and all the stresses that are brought upon it by the waves of the sea, right? And even by its own weight and so on. And also it has to stay upright in the water, and it couldn't be upright if it were a box. It would tend to be, or it would be, it wouldn't be as stable. It could roll on its side, or, you know, there's a lot of different problems associated with the specific shape of a boat. The length of the Egyptian cubit was determined to be 20.6 inches. We said that before, based on the length of the ark as 6180 inches, right? So we divided by, we divided 6180, which is the number of inches of the ark length, divided 6180, there it is, 6180 divided by the 300 cubits given in the Bible. That would mean each cubit was, if I divide instead of multiply, which was my mistake there, okay, divide is 20.6 inches per cubit, which is exactly what we just said. Now, so from the Bible we obtained, you know, the 20.6 inches using the measurement also of the ark as it now still exists as a relic, a petrified wood relic on Mount Judy in Turkey. Moses wrote Genesis and was raised in Egypt, so that cubit to which the Bible refers at Genesis 6:15 may logically be the Egyptian cubit, a distance thought today to be 52.3 to 52.4 centimeters and calculated as 52.324 centimeters, 20.6 inches, which we can do right now. 20.6, right, which is that 6180 divided by 300, divide that number of, we just said 20.6 inches, but divide that by the number of, what are we trying to get it into, centimeters, or, yeah, centimeters. So the number of centimeters in an inch, 2.54, we have to multiply, not divide, that's right, we've got to multiply, because there are 2.54 centimeters in each inch, so we multiply. It's not x, it's multiplication. There it is. 52.324. That's what I wrote down in the article too. 52.324. So we just take the number of inches multiplied times 2.54, because a centimeter is smaller than an inch, so there are many more centimeters, right? And 20.6 inches equals 52.324 centimeters. Which is actually in between 52.3 and 52.4, right? Which is the range thought today to be the range within which the Egyptian cubit falls. So that's exactly right. We're within the range. when we take the measured length of the ark as both 300 cubits and 6180 inches, right, which we did, and divided 6180 by 300 to get 20.6. We multiplied 20.6 by 2.54 to get 52.324. Genesis 6:15 gives the length of Noah's ark as 300 cubits, and the ark length as measured by David Fassold was 6180 inches. Scans at the site showed that the ark had a moon pool and that massive quantities of iron are present where it would have been needed at the aft corners for anchor deployment, that is, the aft corners of the moon pool. I know it seems hilarious. The ark really had a moon pool. And I could hardly get over this when I read about this, that the ark had a moon pool. It seemed like something you'd see on the Love Boat or something, you know, a moon pool in on a boat. Like, where would you see the moon pool today on a vessel? It seemed like it was very modern, the idea of a moon pool. So that the ark had a moon pool, I found that was rather incredible. But yet, this naval architect, Mr. Samuel Windsor, said just that there was a moon pool. And a naval architect is someone who actually designs and builds boats. So if he doesn't know about it, then who would? I mean, it's very, very important work that he did. And I was very blessed that I discovered that he did that work. I just stumbled upon all these things when I was doing research. Of course, I did research quite hard. I did put quite a bit of effort into trying to find things. Now let's continue our watching of the movie, shall we? The Kon-Tiki, the expedition of Thor Heyerdahl in sailing from Peru to the Polynesian Islands.
If only we could circle the entire coral reef, we might be able to land on the other side in the lee of the surf. But as we drifted inexorably on, we could see from the masthead that the submarine reef was so extensive that we had no chance of avoiding it. All we could do was to prepare as best we could to be cast up on the reef. All valuable equipment was collected in the bamboo hut, which we covered with canvas for protection. We then hastily removed the bamboo deck and cut all the ropes that bound the daggerboards. Once these were pulled up, the Kon-Tiki would have such a shallow draft that we hoped it would ride on top of the breakers. Every preparation was made for the moment when the ocean would rise up in its wrath and crash down on us. But I gave orders that no one was to swim ashore or try to land in the rubber dinghy, as this would mean certain death on the sharp coral reef. We should all have to cling to the raft and hope that the graced balsa logs would act as fenders against the deadly reef.
That's going to cause a slight delay there because we have an unfortunate interruption in the broadcast, in the stream there. I'm going to be, when I edit this, the file will get much larger. That's the unfortunate part of it. At least it does typically get larger because I have to add graphics that block the graphics of the ad. So, this is Thor Heyerdahl and his crew as they sail on their raft that they built of balsa wood, giant logs of balsa wood, and he's trying to prove that the South Americans could have sailed across the Pacific. So once this should be nearly over, I think. Who knows exactly when. But, yeah, so it's remarkable to see. Here we go.
Rorby made contact with a radio ham in New Zealand, informing him that we were about to be wrecked on a coral reef and that if there was no sign of life from us during the next 36 hours, he should inform the Norwegian ambassador in Washington that we had perished. His last words were, 50 yards left. Okay. Here we go. Goodbye. He then switched off and crawled out onto the deck to join the rest of us as we clung desperately to our particular ropes. And then it happened, the worst moment of the whole voyage. The crest of the wave reared up like a wall above us, hurling us into the breakers and down onto the reef. 12 curling breakers propelled us in, but every time we were sucked back by the undertow. The 13th breaker was so powerful that it hurled us over the edge of the reef, and when it receded, we were left suspended on top of the coral. With the arrival of low tide, as the ocean slowly ebbed, we found ourselves safe and sound on top of the reef, and were now able to salvage our belongings. The Contiki was now an absolute wreck. The ultra-hard wood of which the mast was made had snapped like a matchstick. The hut had been flattened, the stern crossbeam was broken, and the steering block twisted sideways, while the steering oar and the bow planks had splintered. The bamboo deck had crumpled like a paper bag. There was utter chaos on board. But beneath all this mess, the 9 logs that had brought us safely across the ocean were still intact and had resisted pressure from below. And provided we could hang on to this foundation, we should survive. We managed to inflate the rubber dinghy and started dragging the most important items of salvageable cargo across the reef itself. Both the centerboards and the logs were covered with edible shells, which we used to pick off and cook soup from when out at sea. Here we're using a board as a sort of sledge in order to salvage the last of our water supplies. A dead shark had to be removed as the reef was full of poisonous eels which were attracted by the shark's blood. This particular eel had razor-sharp poisonous teeth and was our only real enemy among all the colorful fish in the quiet waters above the coral reef. Otherwise, the entire reef was a fairy tale world of curious creatures and strange shapes and colors. When we had rescued the most important equipment, each crew member seized whatever meant most to him. Here comes the steward with his kitchen utensils. His Primus stove was ruined by salt water, but he saved his pots and pans, and there was plenty of dry wood on land, so we could carry on cooking our food. Thus we abandoned the wreck out there on the deserted coral reef and waded in towards a small palm-covered island which lay inside the reef in the quiet lagoon. On reaching it, we discovered it to be completely uninhabited. I don't think any of us will ever forget the wonderful feeling of stepping on warm, dry sand and walking on solid ground after spending 101 days on a heaving raft. It was a delightful little island on which we had landed, covered with coconut palms. Our first impulse was to climb one of these palm trees and pick some of the nuts, which we knew were full of cool, sweet, refreshing milk, a delicious taste after our long journey across the briny sea.
Okay. I think we're just about 5 minutes in for that. That's good. Yeah, it's unfortunate that we had the interruption of the ad, because I'm afraid that's going to be making it longer, a bigger file. But anyway, maybe I could find a way to prevent it from making the file bigger. I just haven't been able to do that up till now. So, with our remaining time, I want to show you a few things. We've got just a couple of minutes. I wanted to show you what I bought with regard to the shoes I bought, the running shoes I bought. These are the Asics, which are a Japanese, I believe, manufacturer. They're very high quality. These were $160 Canadian at Sport Check when I bought them. I bought them a couple of years ago, I think now. I forgot that I had them, but they're so lightweight. They're so great for shopping. I can just walk around, you know, and run up and down stairs with these lightweight shoes. It's much easier with these lightweight. And really good fitting shoes. Remarkable. Of course, they're like I said, world-class shoes. If you buy probably a little more expensive variety of them, then they're Olympics quality. But these are the boots I got from Nortive 8, which I told you about. They're marvelous. Let's see. Oh, you know what I'm doing? Let me transition back. Let me show you those shoes again. Let's make it bigger, in fact. Let's make it even bigger so we can, get a much better size. So for these are the ASICs. Yeah, I should have been showing you a much bigger size. For these, they look relatively shapely, but I don't particularly like... Oh, I just banged the microphone. I don't particularly like the, the colors. I just banged the microphone. It's not the microphone. I'm just banging the pop screen, but I should smooth the pop screen a little bit. Yeah, you see? They're not bad-looking running shoes. It's just that the colors are a bit brighter than what I was probably wanting. And here are the boots I bought from Nortive 8. See, they have what smell like and seem to be rubber soles, which should be much more durable than the man-made polyurethanes, which are so temporary in duration. And they have real leather. They're real leather uppers, except for the parts which are fabric part of the uppers, which are for breathability and so on, and also saves cost, of course. But it makes them far more breathable that they have fabric. And then they have, of course, leather here, and I'm trying to think, the tongue is also fabric. Yeah, it's a fabric material on the tongue also. And they have this zipper for ease of, egress, ingress, whatever. And egress on and off is taking of the boots is much easier with that zipper, and you can still keep them laced up if you want all the time. And they're 8-inch high ankle support, soft toe, so there's no steel toe in there. And they're so highly rated by independent reviews compared to Merrell's, for example. So we'll go back now, I think, maybe to the other side. So that's it for today. It's September 11th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 16:38 hours North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. And thank you for listening and watching. And on my behalf, this is Liv Dusty. And this is Cassie. They're saying bye for now. That was paragraph... can't see the watch. There you are. That was paragraph 1-9 of the Ark of Urartu that we studied today, along with another section of the Kon-Tiki movie from 1950.